I really enjoyed being here today at the meditations that are happening in early. I missed a children's event, which was a shame, but I heard it was great. And I love coming into the room and seeing this fantastic shrine. It's very, very beautiful. I'm going to jump straight in with the story of the Buddha, because it all starts with the Buddha. So there's this story of the Buddha and the group of 500 monks that went to see him. They travelled a really long way with the intention of seeing him and being on the annual 3 months rainy season retreat. So they arrive and they're really excited and they're sorting out their lodgings and they're greeting everybody, all the other monks that are there. And unfortunately, in the course of all that, they're making a really loud noise. So you get the impression that it was probably their first experience, going to see the Buddha, being on retreat, and they were just really excited. So they're making this huge noise, and the Buddha hears it, of course, and says to Ananda, his attendant, what is that noise? They sound like a load of fishermen at the shore hauling in fish. So he's not too impressed. So he asks Ananda to bring the monks to see him. So they come to see the Buddha and he greets them. He asks about their well-being, etc. And he then says, what is all that noise? And they say, we've just arrived, really excited, we're greeting everyone, we're sorting out our lodgings, and we're making a really loud racket. The Buddha says, you can't stay here. You have to leave. So he dismisses them. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine sort of walking for days and weeks and arriving and expecting this amazing experience and you're really looking forward to meeting this teacher and you then have to leave. And I imagine, the embarrassment they must have felt, being the only group that were sent off, humiliation, possible, resentment. I can imagine some of them may have been feeling that, but maybe they weren't. What is interesting is Yasodhara, their teacher, their sort of leader, he takes them off into a forest and they make their own retreat there. But before they start, he calls them to him and he says, the Buddha spoke with love and out of our well-being, out of concern for our well-being. And he wants us to dwell in calm abiding. He wants us to, let us act and be and live and dwell in a way that the Buddha would be pleased. So they do. They have their retreat and one by one they soon attain enlightenment. So the Buddha gets a sense that there's this energy coming. He gets a sense of this amazing energy coming from the distance. And he says to Ananda, where the monks went off, I'm feeling this amazing energy, I'm feeling this light. And the Ananda says, yes, it is the monks. They've been doing really well. I've been hearing reports and they're doing really, really well. So he says, tell them to come back. So they come back and when they arrive back, the Buddha's meditating. He's in deep meditation. He's in the fourth dhyana. The monks, being enlightened, they discern this and they sit with him and they also go to that same level in meditation. But Ananda is really concerned because all he's seen is that the monks have arrived and, the Buddha's ignoring them. So he tries to get the Buddha's attention and he says, they're here, they've come, you're going to greet them. And the Buddha just carries on meditating. And then the second watch of the night happens, a few hours go past, and he says, they're here, do you want to greet them? And again, the Buddha carries on meditating and finally dawn, so they've been meditating all night long. The Buddha emerges and says, Ananda, we've been communicating all of this time. Did you not know that? So I find this story is a really interesting story. It's a kind of unusual story in a way. But I found it interesting because I think it kind of gives you a glimpse as to how the Sangha developed in a way. In fact, the whole Buddhist tradition. Because at first, the Buddha taught all his immediate disciples. And then told them to go and spread the Dharma. And then they did. And then they had their followers. And then their followers had their followers. And this is kind of how the tradition developed. They all still revered the Buddha as a person who had discovered the path of enlightenment. They all still looked to the Buddha as a person who'd shown how to end suffering. But because of that, if opportunity allowed, they would go and meet the Buddha. They would travel for weeks and months, you know, however long it took. Although there were many, many people who never got to meet the Buddha in the Buddha's day. They just didn't get the opportunity. So they would bring the Buddha to mind in the way that we still do today. It'd been very natural for them to express their gratitude to the Buddha, but also to express their gratitude to their immediate teacher. Because in the Buddha's day, the only way you would have come across the Dharma would be to actually meet a person. Because the teachings, all the disciples learnt the teachings by rote and then shared them orally. So that was the only way you would be able to know about the Dharma. So you can imagine you would feel naturally grateful to somebody who you just met, and they suddenly poured forth all this wisdom and showed you how to transform your life. So people, even in the Buddha's day, I imagine people did show respect to their immediate teacher, the person with whom they heard the Dharma from. And they would have showed respect. The person like Yasuja was quite interesting because he obviously led them there. But when they had that difficult, challenging encounter with the Buddha, he then also acted as a guide to them. So the teacher shared the teachings orally, but also then showed them where their conduct or their understanding was or was not in accordance with the teaching. And when they had challenges, were able to help them navigate those challenges. So Yasuja is a very skillful guide, he's able to show, because the Buddha didn't actually go into detail in that story as to why he dismissed them. He just says, you cannot stay here. But there is a teaching there for them, it's Yasuja's role to really bring that teaching out so they can understand and then respond accordingly. So that's all very interesting, I think. And then also in terms of Ananda's role, he obviously doesn't, he's this very sympathetic, kind man. He can't see the communication that's happening between the monks and the Buddha. But it's clear, that's another part of the story, it's quite clear that once the monks have attained the same level of realisation that the Buddha has, they're able to really connect with the Buddha. And the Buddha elsewhere says, he who sees the Dharma sees me, he who sees me sees the Dharma. We need to, in order to connect or meet the Buddha, we need to understand the Dharma for ourselves. And we do that for our own direct experience and realization of the immediate teacher's specific instructions. So today we're thinking about Bante, our immediate teacher, founder of this movement. I was asked to reflect on his unique approach to the Dharma. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking about all his formulas and frameworks and all the various ways he's explained, his teachings. But I also was very much thinking about my early encounters with him and with the Dharma. So I'm going to go between the both, really, talking about how it was for me when I met the movement and the Dharma, and then reflecting on Bante's approach. I have met him a few times. I've had several sort of one-to-ones with him, and my son's met him as well. And he's been very, very kind to me. So I do feel a personal connection to Bante. But I think, like most people, I've sort of predominantly encountered his teachings really in his books and recorded lectures. He's got 50 books, more than 50 books. He's written 18 plus, a few years ago they added up, he's got 18 plus million recorded words in his lectures. There's 320 lectures of him on Free Buddhist Audio, the online library. So he really has shared himself very, very generously and opened up the Buddhist tradition for us in doing so. So this is Bante's words now. Spiritual growth is like the development of a tree. First you have a sapling rooted in the earth, and then one day the rain falls, perhaps quite heavily. The rain is absorbed through the roots of the sapling. The sap rises and spreads into branches and twigs, and the tree grows. there is a pause. And then again the rain falls, again the sap rises, and this time not only does it spread into the branches and twigs, but leaves begin to unfold. If no rain falls for a time, the tree may wither a little, but eventually more rain comes. There may even be a real cloudburst, a downpour. And then not only does the sap rise into the branches and twigs and leaves, but flowers begin to unfold. So that's a quote from his book, The Noble Eightfold Path, although when I first encountered it, it was called Vision and Transformation. I really like the quote, and I love the book because it was the first Dharma book I picked up, and it made a very strong impression on me. I was 21. I'd come to the Bristol Buddhist Centre, where I was living at the time, and I'd come in search of answers to questions I had that just kept presenting themselves to me. So these questions were, what's the purpose of my life? How can I be a better person? How can I love more, be more generous? What would it take for me to die without regret and die without fear? How will I know the promise of my birth has been fulfilled? How can I really enjoy my life and help others? So I had lots of questions. I knew that my mind and my heart were key to finding the answers, because I'd had enough experience to show me that there was much more to my mind and to life than I'd been taught in school or read in books, even religious books. So I'll share one of these experiences with you. I was on a plane. I was flying back from the Philippines. I'd been on holiday then. It'd been quite a challenging trip, so that already threw up questions for me. So I was really glad to be getting back to London. It was a long flight, and in the middle of the flight, we ran into turbulence. I think it was 18 hours of flight, so we had just a long period of turbulence. And it was uncomfortable at the beginning, but then it went on, and then suddenly the airplane started dropping, you know, lots and lots of feet. And the air hostesses felt like they were shouting at us to get our seatbelts on, and then the captain was kind of talking and trying to reassure us that everything was going to be okay, and obviously after that you don't think anything's going to be okay. And we were all terrified. Philippines is a Catholic country, so out came the rosaries, and everyone seemed to me, I'm sure it wasn't everyone, but everyone seemed to me to started praying. And I didn't know what to do, because I'd long since sort of rejected Christianity, and I realised I had nothing to... But what am I going to, what's really going to reassure me? I tried to calm myself down, try and tell myself it was okay, but the fear was very physical, and it just sort of bypassed my rational mind. So I sat there and, you know, clenching the seats and just, you know, panicking basically. And at that point, I just turned my head and looked out the window, and I was struck by the most beautiful sky I'd ever seen. It was quite, it's unearthly. I described the time as unearthly because it was lots of colours. There were purples and oranges and reds and blues and black. And then there was this single star that was just shining, you know, sort of luminous. And I couldn't quite believe it, that, you know, where did that come from? I was mesmerised by it. It felt quite mystical. And I stared at it for ages and then turned my head back to the plane. And everything had changed. The plane was still in turbulence. Everyone still had their rosaries out. The air hostess still looked really tense. Everything was the same in the plane, but I had changed. I felt really peaceful. I was no longer in fear. I was enjoying this experience that was in my body and my mind. I wasn't panicking. In fact, my mind was really clear, and I made a decision. In fact, I think it was now thinking about it, it's more of a vow. And I vowed that if we did land safely, I would go in search of answers to the questions I had, and I would figure out how to live a life of meaning. And let go of fear of death and life. So we did land safely. I had a few more experiences, and then I eventually found my way to the Bristol Buddhist Centre, where I was studying. So when I eventually got there, the book, I bought two books. I bought a New Age one on dying and death, and then I bought Bante's Vision and Transformation. And when I read his chapter on vision, I was amazed, because he felt like he described my actual experiences. So he says, for some people, this path of vision arises as a result of personal tragedy, bereavement or loss. Their whole existence is disturbed and upset as though by a great earthquake, in which everything they had cherished or held dear is laid low. In this wreck, this ruin of their lives, they start questioning, start looking deeper, and start wondering about the meaning and purpose of existence. So he goes on to say that as varied as we are as human beings is as varied as the ways these experiences might come for us. So it might be through bereavement, but it might be an experience of nature, art, music, getting older, health issues, relationship ending. I mean, it's as vast as we are, as he said, as varied as we are. But it's really important to honour these experiences, because however painful or disturbing they may be, they are a call from our deeper nature. Our heart's desire is calling us. They are a call from truth itself. So I heard this call at 21, and I responded by taking myself to centre. And when I read the book, I felt like Bante was speaking to me directly. I felt he was telling me, I mean, if he was telling me in this book, that, you know, these experiences are great, you know, they're very important, but they're not enough. And he says that really now I have to transform my whole being in the light of those experiences. So my communication, my work, my actions, my mind, I had to create the conditions where I could actually live this vision day by day. So that the experience wasn't a one-off event, but actually becomes how I live. And it's in this way that he sets out the Buddha's ancient teaching on the Noble Eightfold Path. So I found this teaching really straightforward. It's very direct. I read it as an invitation. So it's like, you know, an envelope arriving in your hand, and you stare at it, and you think, okay, what do I do with this? You know it's important. So, you know, you open it, you look, and there is an experience, a further experience waiting for you. But what do you do? Do you forget about it? Do you put it in a drawer? Do you think, oh, I'll come back to that when I've got more time? And then you remember that it's still in the drawer. Or do you just take a leap of faith and, you know, go for it? So anyway, that's what I did. I just did exactly that. I started practicing. So I got involved. I went to the beginners class at the centres. It was clearly a particular atmosphere at the centre, and the way things were done. And I could see that there were men and women's events and activities and mixed stuff as well. And then I could see there were ordained people. So there was some kind of hierarchy. But at the same time, people dressed like me. They acted, you know, normally. I was really didn't want to be weird. That was my main thing. I wanted to be spiritual, but I didn't want to be weird. And the main thing that everyone seemed to be engaged in a similar conversation about the meaning of life. So I could see there were people that were more experienced than me. They were more positive than I was, freer in the way they interacted. At the same time, I didn't feel separate from them. I thought I could talk to them, and they were genuinely interested in me as well. So that was quite important. It was quite important for me that I felt that, this feels like something I could get involved in, and it also felt important that I knew what my next steps were. It was very clear to me what my next steps were. I only discovered later Bante's six distinctive emphases on of the movement, and I can see now that many of them, if not all of them, were present in my early experiences. So in founding this movement, Bante's created a context where it's possible for us to take that next step, if we choose to do so, and go on a journey that beckons us. One of the principles is the centrality of going for refuge, one of his emphases. So I'll just say what he says about going for refuge. So he says, one goes for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, or in more contemporary idiom, commits oneself to them. When one decides that to attain enlightenment is the most important thing in human life. And when one acts or does one's best to act in accordance with that decision, this means organising one's entire life in all its different aspects in such a way as to subserve the attainment of enlightenment. So when I look back at my first encounters with the movement, I can see now that, yeah, I had an experience of what that means, the centrality of going for refuge. I realised that the order members and mitras that I met at the centre were just more committed than I was. They had organised their lives more than I had, around the Dharma. And yet we were still engaged in the same conversation. So in that quote, Bhante says that to go for refuge with Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you need to decide, well, you know, it's like once you've decided that enlightenment is the most important thing in human life. So I thought, that's a good question, you know, is enlightenment the most important thing? Have we decided that? And so maybe we can't answer a wholehearted yes to that at this stage, like with all of our being. But I think that's okay, because that's what we're practicing. What the centrality of going for refuge means is that being a Buddhist is really about committing ourselves again and again to what we can see the truth is, as expressed by the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, as best as we can, as he says. Because we have had this call, we have had this invitation, however faint, you know, however inconsistent it might appear in our lives, we have had this call. But there will be aspects of us who are not interested in enlightenment, or truth, or reality, that are ambivalent or just fearful about change. There'll be aspects that just want things to remain the way they are. And I think it's important to remember that we are going for refuge to something all of the time. We are committing ourselves consciously or unconsciously to something all of the time. We're getting our sense of security, confidence from something. So, and that might be family, you know, work, reputation, food, internet. What other ones are there? I've missed out. Money, health, sex. You know, there's lots of them, aren't there? So we get in our sense of well-being or confidence from lots and lots of things. But we still, and those things take up our time and energy, but we still have this call. I find that really interesting, that with all of that, with how busy our lives are, we still have this sense that there's something else. That call, as I said, might be really faint. It might come at us with a loudspeaker. It might be like a wake-up, a massive wake-up call, and I must say I've definitely had a few of those. Because we do know that those things, as much as they can give us, they can't actually give us ultimate fulfilment. And we must know as well, deep down, that they're not who we really are. So we get this deeper call, we've had this invitation, there's a decision, isn't there? A choice, do we respond or not? I actually think that once you've had it, it's actually hard to, I think, oh, what happens if you just keep ignoring it? I'm not sure. Certainly for me, I've known that even at times when I've gotten so distracted or busy and I've tried to sort of, oh, I'll do that another time, the call just gets louder for me. You know, it just kind of gets more insistent and persistent, and so I don't know. So I think it's hard not to change, not to take action, really, when you get that. Certainly for the Buddha, you know, once he saw the three sights, old age, sickness and death, whether that happened metaphorically or actually, he couldn't go back to the palace life and pretend he hadn't had that experience and just enjoy himself. That wasn't a possibility for him. So yes, we go for refuge and just keep committing ourselves again and again. And I think that sounds really straightforward on one level. And I think, of course, that's what Buddhists do. That's what I've been doing as a Buddhist. But actually, that was really radical that Bhante created that as our central sort of emphasis. Because actually, the Buddhist tradition has worked quite differently, that if you are serious, if you do want to, you know, be a Buddhist, you have to make a decision about whether you become a monk or none. That is what it was, or a lay person. You know, that's how you knew that somebody was serious committed Buddhist, they became a monk or not. And I think Bhante was a monk. He'd lived that life. But he saw that it wasn't actually necessary. He also, I think, observed that it could create additional difficulties, particularly for women, because the that sort of tradition had died out for women. So women were still becoming nuns, but they weren't getting the support to actually live that life. So personally, I'm very grateful that we didn't have to make that decision. I sort of mentioned that to my son, and he said, well, yeah, his dad too, because he wouldn't have been here if that had happened. So, so another principle that emphasis is that we have a unified movement. Men and women are equal status. So we do have single-sex events, but we are one order, one movement. And importantly, male order members don't have higher status than women. And again, that is quite traditional. For all kinds of reasons, if the monks would give orders to nuns. And personally, again, no matter how politely that was done, I would have found that very challenging. So again, I'm very pleased that we don't have that. It also means, because we have got single-sex activities, it also does mean we can respond specific interests as well. So I appreciate that. Last year we held our first mother's retreat at Tararoa, with no children were present, and it was really moving having women who, you know, were just about to give birth, and those whose children had left home, just about to leave home, and women who'd been practicing meditation for 20 years, and those who were brand new, and discussing, you know, how does the Dharma show itself in our lives as mothers. And a third emphasis that Bhante has in the movement is that we draw from the whole Buddhist tradition. And I've enjoyed this and appreciated this more and more as time's gone on, because I love ritual, which is very much from the Tibetan tradition, but I also love reading stories from the Pali Canon about the Buddha's disciples as well. So I love that aspect. The other aspect of this I was very aware of when I first got involved, because Bhante drew from the whole things that were relevant to us, that he thought would be relevant to us and helpful to us from the whole tradition, and left aside the cultural sort of trappings or additions, if you like, that had grown up around those practices. So I found that I was very aware of this, because I didn't want to take on another cultural identity. And I sort of felt that I might have to if I was engaging in a tradition from one particular place. I felt I was already navigating lots of identities, even at the age of 21. My parents were Caribbean, they come over to this country, I grew up in East London, you know, Cockney, you know, in a minority. So I already felt that I was already sort of working out identity. So I was very appreciative I didn't have to. I could experience the Dharma directly without having to, you know, understand Tibetan culture or understand Japanese culture. So Bhante is very passionate about this, and he says, let us do away with divisions. Let us do away with divisions between monastic and lay Buddhists, between men and women Buddhists, and between followers of different sects and schools of Buddhism. Let us have an integrated Buddhism and an integrated Buddhist community. Let us base ourselves firmly and unmistakably upon our common going for refuge, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So it was very radical. There are three other aspects, emphasis, that he talks about. The arts, right livelihood and spiritual friendship. I might touch on a couple of those later. So I think it's important that, you know, Bhante didn't just think of these in a sort of rational way, you know, like create a strategic plan and that was how he was going to, you know, make the Dharma accessible. It wasn't like that. These very much came out, as I said, of his direct experiences, things that worked and didn't work for his close disciples, and his observations of what was going on in the Buddhist community at large. And I would really recommend, if you haven't read any of his memoirs, to read them, because I think you get more of a sense of his own experiences. So the centrality of going for refuge is key to the movement, and this goes right back to the story of the Buddha's days. You get so many accounts when people met the Buddha and they sort of, you know, he gave them a teaching and then they would be amazed. You know, it's like their heart would just burst and they would just see their vision for their lives suddenly just appearing before them. And out of real, you know, gratitude and disbelief that even that this path was even available, they would say, for the Buddha, to the Buddhas for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. But the texts don't actually go into much detail about what that means. It's Bantay's been unique in actually really looking at about what that means, what that sort of going for refuge actually entails. And so in that sense, he is very much like Yasuja in the story, you know, bringing out a meaning and making something explicit so that it's very, so that we can hear it and understand it and apply it. So in my early days, I read The Vision and Transformation, and I heard about the Noble Eightfold Path, and I loved the word noble. That was what struck me. It showed integrity and something honourable and appealing, just appealing in itself, but also rare in that appeal. I also loved the word path because it thought, well, that's a very ordinary word, path. And it shows me that there's just steps. You just take the steps, and the steps all link together, and you get somewhere. You just have to worry about that. Just take the next step and you'll eventually get somewhere. So I like that as well. I could see that eventually, if I carried on practicing, I would transform, you know, each aspect of my life. But I guess the question that emerged for me then as well, and, you know, still can from time to time, is, well, what is that path, you know, actually like? What's it like to actually travel that? You know, going deeper and deeper at each stage. What does it feel like? What happens? What actually happens to an individual when they start going for refuge at deeper and deeper and deeper levels? So I find that a very interesting question. I don't think about it very much. I'm just doing it. But I'm very glad that Bantay has sort of created another map for us, if you like, for us to really look at the inner journey, what the inner journey entails. So that's the system of practice, the Bantay's system of practice. And the inner journey manifests in one's outer life, and one's outer life contributes to the inner journey. So really, they're not distinct, but it's our whole Dharma life. And again, this is unique. This is a unique presentation of Bantay's. And it has its roots in Buddha's teachings and enlightened beings of the past. But although many of these teachings, all of the teachings, are written in ancient languages for different centuries, so Bantay again has had to, you know, look through them and take out the meaning from them. So let's have a look at this inner journey map now. The first stage is integration. We have to become integrated, become more whole, bring our different selves together, our energies together. And it's also about absorbing new experiences that we might have along the way. Like the tree with the rain, you know, we have to absorb the rain into our very roots so that we can actually be fully transformed. And then each of these phases of the journey, there's corresponding meditation practices. So that the stage of integration has mindfulness of breathing, for example. And we all know about bringing ourselves back to the breath again and again. And then we have positive emotion. So in Vision and Transformation, Bantay says that we cannot go against the emotions. The emotions are stronger than reason. If we want to put into practice what we know to be right, what we know to be true, we have to enlist in one way or another the cooperation of the emotions. We have to be able to tap those deeper sources within ourselves and harness them also to our spiritual life so that we may implement what we know to be right and true. So bringing our whole hearts into spiritual lives, our emotional energies, they can serve us on the journey, is key. And we have the corresponding practices on metta bhavana, brahmaviharas, puja, and arts and culture. I read an article the other day, and the A.L. Kennedy said, beauty and art seem unnecessary luxuries, but they are as essential to our survival as food and water. And Bantay really understands this and really encourages us to explore the arts. So we are more integrated, we've become more emotionally positive, and actually life we could just stop right there, really, I think, in terms of practice, because things are quite good, isn't it, if you're kind of feeling a bit together, more together, and you're feeling happy and connected to people. Our past could stop there. And I've got lots of friends and colleagues who really are very positive and ethical people, and, you know, I admire them. But there's something different about our lives still. And the difference is that I'm going for refuge. So for me, just being integrated, as necessary as it is, and as necessary as positive emotion is not enough for me. I really want to find out how to end suffering. That is key for me. I want to know how to be free completely. So for that, I need to penetrate the teachings much more and more. So there, once you're emotionally positive and integrated, and you keep going for refuge, keep committing yourself, keep opening yourself to the Dharma, then the next stage is spiritual death. It's kind of an interesting phase, really. Challenging. It's kind of like you might feel that you've found yourself suddenly in the desert. And where's the oasis? You're waiting for the oasis. It's where you've kind of firstly, the sort of teachings take us to the heart of our conditioning. We actually have to sort of start looking at ourselves and becoming more... looking at ourselves and it's not always easy, I guess. It's not always easy to face ourselves. And hopefully we have lots of metta and we can do that. We are sort of having to look at ourselves more. And also at this stage, we might actually have an insight into impermanence, into life being suffering. And again, that can be challenging. And it's almost like how we've normally seen ourselves, the things that we've helped us have a sense of ourselves suddenly fall away. And we have to think, well, who are we now? Who are we now? So that's a very challenging phase, but a necessary one in order for us to become more of who we are. I often think of the image of the boats, you know, when you've got to get to the shore and you've got too much stuff in your boat, you know, likes and dislikes, you know, views, identity, there's just too much stuff you're carrying, and you have to just start letting some things go one by one so the boat can actually carry you to the shore. And that's spiritual death. So at that point, we might feel like, as I said, we're in the desert or in the abyss. We might not know who we are, but hopefully we have enough positivity, we have enough integration to kind of, hold that experience. And then it's not the final stage, there's a next stage, and that is rebirth. And hopefully our friends as well, you know, when we sort of come across challenging terrains like that, our friends can remind us that that's not the end, there is a next stage, and it is rebirth, because you're not letting go into nothing. You're letting go into a more compassionate, more open, a more aware person. Sometimes I see it as, sometimes I experience it as stepping out of the way as well. So I have a sense of becoming more of myself, or I have a sense of stepping out of the way so that the Dharma can shine through much more. So letting go of our sort of cherishing ourselves, our cherished selves, and becoming more of who we are. And the stage of rebirth is this more compassionate being, if you like. And then the last stage is spiritual receptivity, which is our capacity to respond and receive what is of value. So natural responsiveness that comes out of an appreciation of truth, beauty and love. And it's allowing a space for things to be revealed, to open up. So we have the just-sitting practice to assist in that stage. And also I've been practicing recently just not doing anything for 5 or 10 minutes. No agenda, no iPad, just sitting. And that's it. It sounds really simple, but actually it's actually not that easy to do. But it's very useful because it's very restful for one thing once you can actually do it. But also it really, it's surprising what can emerge. I had a phase of spiritual receptivity when my son was born, and I didn't expect, I wanted to meditate after he was born. I didn't meditate every day, but I certainly kept up a practice. And then I sort of expected it not to be meditating very well, not to be concentrated, but my experience was completely the opposite. I sit and just enter very easily higher states of consciousness, dhyana. And at first I thought, well, that's a fluke, you know, but then it kind of carried on, kept happening day after day, day after day. And then I realised whether I made effort or not, that I've still had the same experience. So it was really interesting. I remember talking to an order member and telling him what happened, and he said, it's just the fruits of merit. That's what's happening. It's the fruits of merit. So I thought, okay, my practice, therefore, was then just to receive what was happening, the positivity. And it felt like blessings were coming to me. Positivity was coming to me. It was a very interesting experience. And then it went on for a whole year. For a whole year, I didn't really make any effort in meditation. Didn't feel I had to, but still had very concentrated meditation. And then one day it stopped. So it came as suddenly, it stopped as suddenly as it came. And it didn't sort of peter out. It was one day it was all lovely, and then the next day I was, you know, it's like pressing the gas and nothing was there. But it was very helpful remembering what he said, because I thought, oh, it's not, nothing's wrong here. It's the fruits of merit. So if I would like this experience again, which I would, then I've just got to make more effort. I've got to practice ethics and, you know, be mindful, etc. So that's the system of my practice, and it's very comprehensive, and I can't think of anything in my life that doesn't sort of fit in those five areas. So Bhante really is a sort of show of the way. He's kind of giving us a context where we can sort of bring in sort of supports that help us on the journey, sort of the outer journey, if you like, sort of friendships, art, meaningful work, etc. And then he's shown us what the inner journey looks like. What I think is important is that we might not see in his writings our particular experience, a flavour of our particular life. Because I get the sense that he's really writing for his disciples, their disciples, way into the future. So our own particular obstacles or challenges or, you know, hang-ups, however you want to see them, we might not be reflected in Bhante's writings, but he's really giving a very extensive map for us to just keep going back to. So, and it's a bit like, you know, when you go to the Buddhist teachings now. I love sort of reading, as I said, the stories of the early Buddhists, and you know, how different people were even then. I mean, we're massively different, but then as well, you know, so you have the Buddha meeting the banker and the sex worker and the housewife and, you know, the king and all these various people, and then you see their conditioning, you see what they come to practice with, and then you see how the Dharma then penetrates all of that. It's really, I always find that very inspiring. So that's the same for all of us here. You know, we've all got our different backgrounds and we've gone through different things, and then the Dharma comes and penetrates, and we sort of receive it. We choose to go on that journey, and then we change. And I always think it's really interesting as a movement evolves how we will express, you know, what spiritual death looked like for us, for example, or spiritual rebirth or freedom even. So yes, it's this map, this extensive map of all these treasures, and I had a glimpse of the ultimate treasure. So I guess I experience my spiritual journey now as I'm just enjoying the terrain. I'm enjoying being on the journey. I'm very appreciative that I can even take the next step, and then the next step, and the next step, and I have a sense of where it's going. But I'm also enjoying the now of it, of just doing it, the being, you know, going for a future, committing myself again and again and again. But I had a glimpse of the ultimate treasure very early on, again, in my involvement. So I'd read that book, I'd gone on a couple of, I'd gone on one weekend retreat and for beginners, and I'd gone to some of the classes at the centre. I didn't call myself a Buddhist. I felt that I was very interested in finding out who the Buddha was. That's what I wanted to do. And then one day at the class, Mitra said, oh, there's an event going on in London. Do you want to go? And Bhante will be there. So I was like, okay, the guy who wrote the book, that's fine, I'll get to meet him. And my family were in London anyway, so I thought I'll go and visit them and pop into this event that was happening. leave, you know, after a bit. So I walked into, it was York Hall, this event, and I walked into York Hall and there were hundreds of people there. And that might feel all right, you know, being at the LBC, but I was at the Bristol Centre and there was, you know, a class would be a dozen people. So to walk in and there was hundreds of Buddhists was a very strong experience by itself. It was a really lively atmosphere, a real sense of occasion. People were greeting each other, so obviously lots of characters there. And at the front, at the stage, was a huge picture of a Tibetan monk. There were people on the stage talking, and well, Bante was there, so I got to see Bante for the first time. I think I have a memory that he was wearing a tweed jacket, but you know, it was very, you know, suit and tie. And I liked him straight away, although I found him, he was unlike anyone else I'd met. I guess maybe a cross between a professor and a GP or something. But really, unlike anyone else I'd ever met, he spoke really deliberately and clearly without deliberating. He was very thoughtful, and there was always a glint in his eye at certain points, like a real sense of humour. He was clever, he was direct, and spoke with real clarity. But he wasn't the focus of the occasion, because the occasion was celebrating the life of the monk on the picture, and it was his first death anniversary. So I sat and listened as person after person got up and spoke about this monk whose name was Dado Rinpoche. He was a friend of Bante's and one of his teachers. I was impressed by all the speakers. They seemed really confident, self-assured. They spoke from the heart. Both men and women spoke. There was one woman there who I was particularly struck by, who spoke very beautifully. And I remember thinking, she seems very ethical, and that's a very beautiful thing. And then there was Dado himself. Bante spoke about him as a living bodhisattva. So that was a new term for me. And even if the term hadn't been explained, I would have known from the stories what it meant somehow. Because person after person spoke about this man who had sort of unfailing, you know, generosity, his deep kindness, his connection to people, to children. He set up a school for Tibetan refugees and was tireless in maintaining his school. His devotion to practice, his personal practice, he'd get up really early in the morning, do several hours before the day started. And he was an excellent Dharma teacher, giving Bante very important teachings and initiations. And then he also cared for and taught Bante students that went out to see him as well. So hours later, I was still in this room, listening to all of these talks, and a whole other vision had opened up for me. And that was of the Bodhisattva, somebody dedicated to the welfare of all beings, and someone in whom the bodhicitta, the altruistic principle, is expressing itself through. I think prior to that, I was thinking very much of my, you know, path, my sort of transformation, and suddenly I thought, oh, it's not about me. You know, there's a much bigger thing going on here. So at the end, it was announced that they were going to do a sevenfold puja to close the proceedings. So I turned to the guy, the only person I knew. I said, what's a puja? And he said, you're about to find out. So I think Bante led the puja. Were you there, Mudutashri? Yeah, you were there. I think I saw you there. Well, that was a whole other experience, doing a puja. Hundreds of people passionately reciting and prostrating full length in front of this picture. So a bit of me went, oh my God, this is weird, what's going on? Because all my conditioning was coming out on one level, but actually most of me was just deeply moved. And actually I wanted to prostrate myself. I didn't, because I didn't know how and all the rest of it, but I wanted to, so I sort of mentally sort of, you know, bowed to Dado. And then, of course, we had the Heart Sutra. So hearing the Heart Sutra for the first time, and how, I mean, I didn't, on one level, I don't understand this. But on the other hand, I thought, it's the truth. It's the truth. And if this is what Buddhism is, then I am a Buddhist. And I think what appealed to me was because it was beyond me. the whole sutra and the puja, it was all beyond me. It represented something, therefore, I could grow towards, and in my mind, never get bored of. And then I saw through this monk what a life fully lived actually looks like. A loving, compassionate, free person, unobstructed, yet kind and intelligent, lots of energy too. I thought, well, that's what it must look like to actually arrive at the certain point where you can taste enlightenment. And I see how rare it was for somebody like that to come into the world, and so how valuable it would be for me to just take the next step to, you know, move closer and closer to that. So if I wasn't a Buddhist before that day, I certainly became one. The woman on the stage, who I was impressed with, became my preceptor, and she's played an important part of my life. I heard that Bante had said, I think he might have said it on the day or later, that Dardo regarded Bante's disciples as his own. And I thought that was interesting. And then I found that when I've been going through challenging times, Dardo has just appeared. I haven't sort of necessarily, you know, called into mind, but he has come to mind. So I feel like somehow, you know, we're really benefiting from Bante's achievements and Bante's insights, but there's so much more as well. And that's quite a remarkable thing to think about. So I'm not sure actually how I'd live my life if it wasn't for Bante and if it wasn't for making the Dharma accessible to me, and also all the people I've met as well, who I would never have met those people otherwise. So Bante, through his understanding and his insight, he has entered into deep communication with the Buddha, a deep communication with other enlightened beings. You know, deep communications with his disciples who've helped create this movement that we're part of and we're benefiting from. I love the fact that we can have real guides, friends who we can sit and have a cup of tea with, who are not so remote from us, and at the same time we can be influenced by invisible guides as well. I feel is that people, those Bante and others, they just keep practicing, they keep encouraging us to just take that next step, keep going for refuge, committing ourselves again and again. But there are lots of things that can help us in the way, like art and beauty, lighting our path. And when the time's right, and when conditions come about, we'll find our treasures. I've certainly found, you know, I kind of have faith in sort of the ultimate treasure because I can see those treasures along the way. And we keep sort of responding to that call, going for refuge. And I think eventually we find we're becoming what we're seeking. Being able to respond, you know, positively more and more to others. Feeling less of a sense of separation. And being open to the mystery of our own nature and the mystery of the Dharma that's unfolding within us and around us.